has to be made about the concept of freedom, whether it is in relation to freedom of women in the church or in the world or any other kind of freedom, then that is connected with the ambiguity of the term. And this afternoon, when in the questions and answers that followed Dr. Tijan's talk, I felt that there was some ambiguity about that concept of freedom in some of the questions. I think we have to keep in mind two very different meanings of the word freedom. I'm falling back into linguistics, you'll forgive me for that, but I started that way, so I'll continue. One is, there is the freedom of choice. It's what we usually call democratic freedom, the freedom to choose the way of life that we want, the profession that we want, the freedom to speak our mind, the freedom to elect whom we want within the limits offered by the system. And there is another kind of freedom, which is the freedom of the children of God. Now, one of these two freedoms is more or less at the beginning. It is the kind of freedom that we need in order to live as free individuals, capable of making our own decisions for which we will be responsible. And we are entitled to the protection of society for that kind of freedom of choice. The other freedom is one which we cannot acquire, which is given to us, and which is more at the end of our own pilgrimage than at the beginning. The freedom of the children of God, the freedom of being with God, the freedom of understanding things as God understands them, and the freedom of following Him. It is the kind of, in the language of St. Augustine, in which I tend to fall back sometimes, the first one is liberum arbitrium, free choice. The second kind is libertas, liberty, freedom, that which is practically identical with the kingdom of God. A freedom which really doesn't exist fully in this world, but in the next. And I think for instance, Martin Luther speaks about freedom in his great little book on Christian liberty, it is more the second kind of freedom that he has in mind. In the authentic Christian life, there is an anticipation of the full freedom of the children of God, insofar as we are already in God, transformed by the grace of God, called by it, and we respond to it. And out of this response, this interchange between God and us, there comes our participation in God's own freedom. Now, the other kind of freedom, freedom of choice, I think, is the sort of thing that we speak about when we speak about the freedom of woman in the church. She's entitled, she wants to have the free choice, the widest possible range of free choices. This is the kind of freedom we speak when we want a free society, when a group of persons in our society have simply finally awakened to the fact that they have been discriminated against, they call for that freedom, they require it, it is their right to have it. Now, the second kind of freedom, which really is first in the order of things, but is a means to the other freedom, the second kind of freedom I think we can learn from history has never been given to anybody. It has always been conquered. It has always had to be acquired. And it's not, it won't be given, I think, to whether it is to women lib movement or black movement, it will never be given by those who have, vested interest in not giving it. It will always be conquered. And you mustn't be afraid to be revolutionaries, because it's only a kind of revolution that can bring it about. A revolution which implies in our case, a transformation of the way of thinking or the way of doing things, a very profound transformation, which is necessary in order to be able more fully to reach the other kind of freedom, the libertas, the freedom of the children of God. I think we have come to a time now in the history of the church, also in the history of mankind, when this this conquest of freedom, of free choice, is a requirement for the so that more persons in the church have the chance, the openness, and the openness necessary to receive from God this ultimate freedom that we have no right to, but that we have been promised by the Lord.
Oh, you know, I really look upon, well, let me just say, I identify the greatest revolutionary as the woman. And I really think that the greatest revolutionary was Eve, above everybody else, because she radically changed this whole world for everybody, including God himself. Now, that is really something. She changed it from all good to part evil, you know, because she had a sense of the other. And I don't think we should ever underestimate our powers, potentials, and dangers as women, you know, because she's it. She has never been identified as this. In fact, we really want to claim Jesus Christ as being the greatest revolutionary. But in fact, Jesus had to come because of Eve. See? Ain't that cool?
Come on.
I'm not exactly sure I want to pick up on that. but one thing I do want to put, and it picks up on something that you said before, and I'm not sure I'm arguing with you, but I'll find out. As I mentioned before, I've been very much involved in very specific women's liberation groups. And I think one of the things that is necessary, and I think this also picks up on the question of freedom, that simply having women write books at the moment, I would want to know what women. That I think there are enormous numbers of women within the church who have bought totally the perspective of theology as objective, the perspective of what they are to be, which is given. And that I think one of the things, it's not only, you know, equal job opportunities, things of this sort, which are important, but I think the other half of what many of the women's liberation groups are doing is one thing that also we need, and I would put it in as a way of counteracting the effects of total depravity or something, that I don't think we are really aware of the insidious character of the role typing, of the stereotypes in which we live, and that in order to write, or in order to think what is really from our own perspective, we have to get in touch with that perspective. And a good many times we are not there. The perspective we take is the perspective that is given. And I think that, which is called consciousness raising, but that awareness in which we must stand, or else we cannot speak as women. We simply speak what has been spoken before. We do not put in a different perspective. I think that element, which is the way partly of becoming free, and becoming free really to be women within the church, is the other half, not just the job opportunities. I think that also is a necessity. But I think a great deal of what is being done, and I just do not get intimidated by the term women's liberation, and I think a great deal of women, a great many women do, and I think it, because it carries all kinds of baggage, which it needn't, but I think, you know, we get intimidated by the term. And I think that level of consciousness raising, which is an ability to be free, and to be free as women, which we are not, and I think that is another element, which in many respects we should not simply take in a secular fashion, that I think within the church we need to know what this means so that we learn what it means really to be Christian women. And I think the degree to which the church is turned off by this level of women's liberation, to that degree the women within the church are not free to find out what it means to be Christian women. So it's not only job opportunities in terms of ordination or anything else, which I still think is very significant, but it is also even the real freedom to be women within the church, which we do not possess, and partly because of our own bondage because we have thought as objective and as the only possible way of interpretation the things that have been given us.
Sorry, she asked if I want the microphone, and I said not particularly, but since nobody else is jumping for it, always glad for a chance, I'd like to go along with what Dr. Gonzalez has just said, and I don't think, again, I don't think I'm disagreeing with Sister Martin DeForest, but just saying that from my point of view, there is a very real need at this point in history for us as church women to get over some of our inhibitions, and I think quite natural and understandable inhibitions about speaking out or demanding, if you will, or something of that kind. And for not for our sakes particularly, although presumably this will benefit many of us, but really for the sake of the church, I would say eventually for the sake of the kingdom, where I believe very sincerely God needs and wants the contributions of all kinds of people, black and white and male and female and so on, in the thinking, in the building of the kind of a society that seems to be coming, that we simply have a responsibility, even though it is, for some of us, perhaps almost uncongenial to become part of a kind of a militant women's movement. It seems to me that we must take this seriously. We must not be afraid of it. We must try to help ourselves and other women gain the kind of self-confidence. Now, there are people who just have it, and I think it is a very great gift and a wonderful thing. I believe completely Dignus Grace Noreen when she says that she feels so comfortable with her role that she feels very free. And I think there are people who have this, I think perhaps it's just a little bit deeper faith than some others have, but who can have that. We all need it. And we can help one another to secure it, I believe, if we will do just exactly what we're doing here. I couldn't help going back for a moment to the question that was raised by a couple of the groups as to why in this kind of a conference, most of the speakers are men. We had lots of fun. None of us were on the planning committee, so we don't know the real reason, but we were speculating. And some of the reasons could be very good reasons. It could be, for example, that the people who planned this felt that to be a really good and worthwhile conference, we needed the contribution of both men and women. And I would kind of gather that just in terms of the facilities of the college and so on, wouldn't be very easy to have a mixed men and women's conference. It was easier to have more possible to have a conference, participants in which were women. And the only way to get a good masculine viewpoint in here for us to work against was to bring who are progressive in their thinking, that it might be helpful for us to discover that there are such men. It might also have been in their minds to get some men here and do a good job on them. Maybe we're trying to convert them, I'm not quite sure. But it seemed to us that there might be a good many very real reasons for doing this. On the other hand, it is possible, and I have no way of knowing, it is possible that the planners of this conference fell into the same trap that I find myself falling into many, many times. When one is going to plan a conference, when one wants someone to speak on theological and religious subjects, we just don't think of anybody except the men whose names are well known to us. And this is part of the bind that we're in today, and the necessity, and raises the necessity for our doing a good deal more thinking, and as Sister Dignus Grace Noreen was saying, getting more women who are willing to speak out verbally and in writing and so on, and begin to have their ideas known, so that we will think about them when we have a conference like this.
If I may, I'd like to talk to that issue too. That is the issue of men on the conference program. I really did not give much thought to that question when I was asked. That is, to the question of a program that was intended for women who minister that would have a predominantly male series of presenters. I didn't think about it, frankly, because, I just don't. and that shows something, right, Kevin? I'd like to make two points, not about this particular conference, but about the issue in general. I think there needs to be two sets of forums for discussion at the present time. The one forum is where women discuss with women the significance of basic theological questions for them. Without the, well, it may help to have a male around to react against in the process, but I think it is terribly important for women to be doing the theological job that has to be done themselves in this particular area. And that's true both whether you're going to be raising the question of woman and its significance for women in the church, and if you're going to raise the, or if you're going to raise the question of women who minister and the commonality of ministry, as Sister Martin was suggesting, there are two possibilities here. On the other hand, I think there needs to be that kind of forum where men and women can be discussing these kinds of issues. I know for myself, I personally have been very much profited and benefited by my conversations with many of you. But the purpose of this conference is not to be of benefit and profit to me. That's not why I'm here, I'm sure. That's a kind of extra bonus that comes to me as a result of being in it. But I do think that there needs to be that sort of a forum where a person like myself and a whole bunch of other people like me have the benefit of rethinking our own position on the basis of responses which you make to us. That's been eminently profitable for me.
I just have to make another comment here. I personally do not espouse women's lib. Maybe I should say as a priority. I think that some of the things that I'm involved in come to certain kind of results that will accidentally influence what we like to term as women's lib. And I don't espouse it because I really believe in the co-prominence of man and woman. And when I listen to people deliver in the areas of women's lib, it seems like there's a real verbal and interior force to exchange oppressorship. And this is why I like to deal with the concept of co-prominence as opposed to the prominence of woman, you know. And I think it's important that we, now I'm gonna, you know, I relate to you, as women try to become a sign of contradiction to everything that belongs to the intrinsic value of being man. Those things, when I say everything, I mean those things that keep women oppressed, you know, and we have to become this sign of affirmation, but always conscious of co-prominence, you know.
One of the questions that one of the groups, it's almost like a statement put forward of, isn't the basic issue that I, as an adult woman, want to be able to serve in the way I wish and not to be limited just to this area or that because I am a woman? And I think this came out pretty definitely by what everyone said. And because I am, you know, a member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, I particularly, as an individual within that church body, don't care to be ordained. But I do feel that within my own church body, that women should have that privilege to make that choice. And I can tell you that we, as a women's group within the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, struggle very greatly with this particular issue, and that many of our very prominent women are not women within our church body doing ministering in the church, but they are ministering outside of our church because of this particular stance that our church does not, you know, allow us. And yet I have found my own place within that system, right or wrongly, in your opinion. In mine, it's all right. But perhaps this is part of the thing, you know, it is, the question is that we should have that choice, you know.
That relates, doesn't it, to what Father Devard was saying about the different kinds of freedom, and that this freedom of choice may be very fundamental and very important. There's another question here that we were just looking at, which I would like to just toss out and see if various members of the panel might want to say something to it, because I think it's a fairly fundamental question. This group said, how do you propose to go about affecting the ministry of women in the church and in the world? Would some of you like to just play with that one a little bit? How do you propose to go about it?
I think it's one thing to try and change a situation in a church that does not ordain women, although I think the same method, and this I find from personal experience very definitely, that I think one of the greatest needs is for models. And I think both...
And if they got the word.
For models. So that both that that women within the church have seen women ministers. That they have seen them, and that congregations have seen them, that congregations have heard them, and that they discover that when a woman minister preaches, serves communion, that lightning bolts do not strike, that the floor does not open up, and that the congregation survives and enjoys it. Mm-hmm. And I think it is more the attitudes before anyone ever appears on the scene. And I think especially for women who are ordained, there is a kind of built-in responsibility to be somewhat peripatetic and to appear, and especially, I know, I would say maybe 3 years ago, I would not have been caught dead speaking to a women's group. I really didn't care for them. I would say that at the moment, if I can fit it into my schedule, I would not turn down speaking in a local church women's group. Before I wouldn't have cared to preach in some rural church in the middle of nowhere, but I would never turn it down because you keep thinking there's one more that survived. And I think that attitudes change partly when they have seen someone in flesh and blood who does not live up to the stereotypes that a congregation has already assumed, that you're actually human, that you're not man-eating, that you're fairly normal. And I think that this becomes one of the greatest problems. But I think living models who actually perform and who do it, I think becomes both the greatest way to increase the number of women who do it. I mean, I think everybody needs some kind of a model. You frequently do it without, but I think a model at least presents to your subconscious an alternative which you never thought existed. And I think this is one reason why I think that the question of where women are, and I think this is true in the ministry, but I think it is also true in things like college teaching. I think it's true in seminary teaching. If the only women are in Christian education, that says something. And it says something as a model for all the women who even think of entering a field. Where the only women in the church are doing very traditional things, it says something to all the women in the church about what women can do. And so I think it's both a responsibility of church bodies to hire women and to give them the opportunity to be supplies in places that are without pastors, or to open up places just so that, maybe not as a permanent job, but just so that model function comes through. Because I think that business of providing a model, but I think it does add responsibility on the side of the few women who are ordained, that it gives you a great sense of responsibility of a ministry which is far beyond the context of what you actually are doing at that moment. I think you're performing a different ministry at the same time.
Good. Anybody else want to say something to this question of how we propose going about it? I think I'd like to just say a word building on what Dr. Gonzalez is saying, which is, I think her idea of the necessity for some models is one that we could all take seriously, even those of us who, like Deaconess Grace and Rena myself, are in churches where at the moment the priesthood at least is not open to women. There are things we can do, and I think we have a responsibility to take the opportunities that God offers us, even when they may sometimes be not very congenial, or when we suspect it's tokenism or something like that. But if we are asked to be on a committee, to write something, to take a position, to carry some responsibility, if we could keep in mind what Dr. Gonzalez has just said about the great need for the mass of women in the church just to see women in these positions and discover that the world doesn't come to an end, this might give some of us the courage to do things that we don't always want to do very much.
I'd like to say a few words about ministry, not exactly about how to make effective ministry of women in the church, but to take the broader question of what is ministry. There's one question asking what is ministry and what are its different options. I have been very much involved in the past few months, and I will be for next year again, in ecumenical discussions about ministry. I am at this moment writing three different papers on the question. One for Catholic Episcopal Conversations in this country, one for the Catholic Anglican International Conversations, and another one for the Catholic Methodist Conversations in this country. And they will be different. They will be three different papers. Now, there is a great deal of discussion about what is ministry, and particularly keeping in mind the prospect of a reconciliation of ministries eventually between churches that do not today recognize each other's validity of ministry, etc. In the kind of typology I like to set up in my own mind about kinds of ministries, I have a structure which may not be complete, but I find it helpful. I think that ministry can be divided, as it has been traditionally practiced in the different Christian churches, in four kinds or four aspects. I see the minister as a liturgical leader, particularly in relation to Eucharistic worship, the president of the community at prayer, this sort of thing. The minister also has been particularly closely connected with preaching, proclamation of the message, announcing the gospel, ministry of preaching. He has been particularly connected with what I would call, in a broad sense, education, particularly, you know, Christian education, catechetics, etc. And fourthly, he has been connected with the various structures of service that have been set up in the churches. One time, perhaps, it was hospitals, medieval hospitals, practically all of them, started and maintained by the church. It may be another type of service in the various problems that are met in our urban situations today. The differences I find in the various Christian churches on ministry bear not on the existence of these four types of ministry, but on which one predominates. We have, I would say that in general, in the churches that can be called Catholic, you know, the Catholic tradition, it is the first structure of ministry that predominates, the one that connects the minister with, particularly with Eucharistic worship. In other churches, traditional Reformed churches, the minister of the word predominates over the others. And in other churches, we find that it is the service of, or the structure of service that predominates over the others. The question of reconciling ministries between different churches really concerns the question of how to reconcile, reunite these different types of priorities. Are they such as to be exclusive of each other, or can they be somehow reconciled into one? And now, the question I would have, now in relation particularly to question of ordination of women, concerns the necessity of, or the non-necessity of ordination for these different types of ministries. As I understand ordination in my own Catholic tradition, ordination would be needed only in the strict sense for the ministry of presiding over the Eucharistic worship, whereas the ministries of preaching, of service, of education can very well be performed, be entrusted to persons who are not ordained. Now, it is quite true that in other church traditions, ordination doesn't really mean exactly that, but refers to the call, the sending by the church, the entrusting by the church of a certain task. And then ordination can be seen then in connection with all these types of ministries. And the question of ordination of women to priesthood in the Roman Catholic sense, to me, is raised only in relation to the first one, in relation to the minister as the president of Eucharistic worship, and not in relation to the other three. And in fact, all types of ministries have been performed without ordination. Types of ministries certainly connected with education, certainly connected with service. And I would not see any need to bring ordination into these types of ministries. And it is quite possible to conceive that, taking the general picture of the church, it would be unadvisable at a particular time to open all these types of ministries indifferently to men or women. I'm not theologically. I have taken sides already quite a long time ago, and I have written quite clearly that I do not see any theological objection to ordination of women to the priesthood in view of the first type of ministry of Eucharistic worship. But taking the whole picture of the whole Christian world and the necessities, the necessary slowness of reconciling ministries between different churches, I can see that the church can hesitate to take a step that would antagonize another one. For instance, I'm thinking of the growing relationships between Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church. I think this is this growing relationship that is much more than friendliness or and better understanding would certainly make many churchmen hesitate to open ordination in the strict sense to women, because another church with which we are in a very close relation at this time is not open to it at this moment. So there can be drawbacks to the sort of thing that may be asked for, drawbacks that are due simply to the broader world picture in which we are. I think we have to take account of this broad picture.
I'd love to respond to that. I don't know, can't remember whether any of you were at the conference on the Ministry of Women that was held up at Graymore last year, but this particular point that Father Devard raises is one that has interested me very much. I agree with much that he said in the early part of his comments, that I'm sure one of the ways of coping with this whole problem of ministry and the place of women in ministry will begin to be solved as we broaden our concept of ministry and broaden it not just for women, but for the entire thinking of the church. But as an Anglican, one of the things that has bothered me very much is the fact that, by and large, the churches that come out of the Catholic tradition, and here I'm thinking particularly of Anglican, Eastern Orthodox, and Roman Catholic, are the ones which seem primarily to be having real hang-ups over the problem of the ordination of women. And over the years, and I know some of my Anglican friends here will agree with this, over and over again, when we've had study committees on this in the Episcopal Church, they've come out finally saying strongly, there is no, absolutely no, biblical or theological reason why women should not be ordained to the ministry. The only reason we don't recommend it, or ordained to the priesthood, the only reason we don't recommend it is it might cause difficulties in our relationships with the Roman Catholics or our relationships with the Eastern Orthodox, and it therefore is not expedient. And at the Graymore Conference, the thing I was pleading for was, why can't some of the leading theologians of the Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, and Anglican churches get together and solve this problem instead of each one of us using the other as an excuse for not doing anything? Because partly because I have to leave and partly because we can see how tired all of you are, we're going to cut this off in about 10 minutes. But would some of you like to toss up questions? We haven't tried to cover everything on the sheets because there were so many of them. But if there's something that you asked and that you really want some response to, would you just speak up? Or if you'd like to, you know, argue with us or comment on something that's been said.
Would you like to go to your room? Said, would you like to go to your room?
I don't think we'll let you go quite yet. I suspect some people here still have some things that they would like to have a chance to say, would you? Anybody on the panel? among the Methodists in Great Britain. Yes. And I understand it is presenting something of a problem in the consultation on church union, although I think they're beginning to work it through there. But I think this is a typical kind of thing that we do when we're a little reluctant to do something. You try to find somebody else to blame it on. Yes, Sister Ida.
I'm glad to answer that question, because I am all for ordination of women. I am not at all for a married clergy. To me, the two things are quite different. Dropping the law of celibacy to meet the request of some, the request of some that have come up in the last 15 years, to me are not such as to justify changing something that has been going on for, I don't know how many centuries. And the fact that there are people who make a request is not as such a sufficient reason to accede to the request. Again, I think we have to keep in mind the broader picture. Something like dropping the law of celibacy for the clergy or changing the law about ordination. It must be part of the broader reform of the church, which is in process now. And I ask myself, what would be the result for the whole church? I think the ordination of women would make a considerable change in the ways of doing things in the church. Not just if you ordain one or two, that kind of tokenism that's very fashionable. But if you ordain enough to have an influence. A friend of mine who is a pastor of a church in central Pennsylvania, I heard him once give a sermon to his people in which he said, my dear parishioners, priests are leaving the priesthood so fast that very soon I will be in a position of influence. Well, you must be in a sufficient majority to be in a position of influence. It's not ordaining a few women or changing the law as such. I think that would bring about a new atmosphere in the church, but it's having enough competent women ordained and in positions of influence. That would, I think, radically change the pattern of doing things, the ways, the mode of authority, the kind of leadership that has been exercised by the clergy. And therefore, this would be a very important ingredient in the present reform that is going on, that has been going on since the beginning of Vatican Council II. I do not see, on the other hand, that the possibility for priests to marry would change anything at all in the general picture of the church. A married man is just as conservative and reactionary as non-married men, sometimes much more. They certainly have much less freedom. And if you must have persons who have the possibility of all kinds of initiatives in a ministry, who do not feel tied. One of the great questions that is being debated now, one of the basic objections that we find in our theological circles to ordination of not the ordination of women, but to the marriage of priests, is that until now, our priests have been considered as persons whose first duty was to the church, to their congregation or to their assignment in the church, but first of all to the church. But as soon as you are married, your first duty is by natural law to your family. And therefore this completely changes the whole spirituality of the priesthood. And what would be the result for the church in general? Once you are functioning with a system of married clergy, you just continue The difficult thing is to pass from one system to the other system gracefully. Now, well, God knows that in the 16th century, the passage in the Church of the Reformation was not a graceful passage. No. And we don't want to go through that kind of thing again. No. The problem then is to either change very gradually, no, or not change at all. So that I am, as I said before, much more interested in that which will be effective for the reform of the Church. And the fact that there are some whose desires are not met is, in my opinion, a relatively unimportant thing. I would not consider any difficulty from that point of view in the direction of the Anglican Church. The difficulty I raised was in the direction of the Orthodox Church. I do not think that ordination of women in the Anglican Church or in Lutheran Church or in other Western churches would be ultimately an obstacle. And the obstacle would be our ordination of women in the eyes of the Orthodox Church, which is a different perspective. They are the married clergy of persons who are married men who are ordained. Well, because in the Orthodox theology and canon law, the ordination of women raises many more problems than in the theologies of other churches in relation to the pattern of living established by the fathers in the first seven centuries. It's not something that is easy to overcome. And it's not just habits, no, on their part. It's a real theological problem that is not felt to that extent by anybody else. But you have to take account of that. I would expect her to do the same thing, to do it much better. Well, I think I would agree with that if you did not use the term used. No. Because I don't think women in the church should be used. They should give themselves to the church and to be able to function and serve the church, yes. But the categories of use should be out, I think.
I think in response to this last comment, I'd like to come back to something I was probably not being able to say very effectively because I haven't really thought it out in my talk this morning. But it seems to me that more often than we realize, when we are talking about ordination, our focus is not really on the opportunity for ministry, which ordination brings, but is really, at least subconsciously, on the fact that in the tradition of all of our churches, ordination has become synonymous with the decision-making power, and that there is a strange something here. I would agree with you that if it were just in terms of ministry, there perhaps are many things that women can do better than men, and if we left the saying of Mass and so on to the men, this would be a very small loss. But when within the concept of ordination is the whole concept of the administration, the governance, the decision-making, and this is by no means limited to the Roman Church, this is true in the most Protestant churches, then I think we do come up against some very real questions. And as long as that exists, I think women are going to have to fight for that kind of ordination. Sometimes I think it'd be much more fun to fight for a totally different concept of the way in which the church is governed, and a much more participative kind of thing where the ordained person simply took his place as a member of the laos, as a member of God's family, and didn't carry special power.
This is not the place for a man to disagree with another man.
You gotta stick together.
I was struck by Father Tavard's statement. I don't really know how it is for most other clergymen who are married. I know that the fact that I have a responsibility to wife and children places a considerable burden on me as I carry out my responsibilities to ministry, in ministry. The fact is that for me, I don't know about that natural law, Father Tavard. I consider my first responsibility is to my Lord. And he has called me into various stations in life, I think. One of them, I believe, was marriage. And another one was to be a father. He also called me to function in the ministry of the church. And I see that as part of a total responsibility which I have to him. That sometimes creates considerable tension in my life as I balance out the claim of one calling on the claim of another. And very often somebody gets the short shrift in the process. I suspect that in most instances, in my case, it is not the church that gets the short shrift, but probably my family.
I think every clergyman's wife would agree with you. This does mark the end of the time that we had all agreed upon. We'd love to keep this up for a long time, but we think perhaps tomorrow would be better if everyone is not too tired. Thank you very much. I know you want me to thank all the members of the panel, and we've enjoyed this.